You're listening to KZSU Stanford 90.1 FM, and now we listen to the question and answer section that followed the panel discussion that discussed why more war and the popular support for military intervention. The event happened at Stanford on October 15th, 2014, and was organized by Stanford's Peace and Justice Initiative. Their website is peacejustice.stanford.edu.
So first, I want to thank all three panelists for terrific presentations today. Before we get into the discussion, we want to bring together our panelists with all of you in discussion. And what I thought, kind of drawing out a comment that Martin made at dinner before we came in here, was that we should focus on what we're for. And I think all the presentations kind of suggest different aspects of that. But for me, it breaks down into a few different categories. So what is it that we need to do as a society, and maybe also what is the academic part of that, to pursue peaceful instead of warlike approaches to conflict around the world? What's needed in a field like peace and justice studies, for example? What would it look like for us to be successful? Secondly, at the level of movement building, what, in terms of popular movements, the anti-war movement casts itself as a movement against war, but the student anti-war group on campus recently changed its name to Students for Alternatives to Militarism, emphasizing that there are alternatives and we should be promoting those. And finally, to harken to Linda's perspective, what does this mean for us, specifically at Stanford, and in relation to our initiative in peace and justice studies? So bringing it as close to home as we possibly can. So I'm going to give the panelists each another shot at addressing those questions and anything that came up in the other panelists' presentations that they want to, and then we'll open up for questions. So we'll start with Martin.
Thank you, Todd. Well, just to build on the comment that at dinner, someone said, oh, so you're anti-nuclear. And I said, no, I'm not anti-anything. We can't just be anti. We have to figure out what we're going to build instead. I put it in terms of a slogan that from the 80s, we're not out to slay the dinosaur. We're trying to build a gazelle.
Yeah. I would be eager to get to the audience, so I have nothing to add.
I think it's important to build not only an anti-war movement, but a pro-peace movement, a movement that includes an end to militarism, but also the kind of funding and programs for education, healthcare, infrastructure, jobs, that $10 billion, that's not $10 million a day that's been spent now could be used in a lot more productive ways.
So we'll start.
Thank you guys, that was really great. Just two little factual points I want to add to Martin's thing about Afghanistan is that not only all of that was, you said was true, but also the Taliban offered Osama bin Laden to Qatar. So that was something I want to say. But I want to actually ask a question about...
Actually, since we're trying to repeat things, can you slow? The point was made that the Taliban actually offered to turn over Osama bin Laden. I think it wasn't just to Qatar, it was to any Muslim nation for trial. But we refused that, yeah. So it was more complicated than
okay. It's great.
Okay, go ahead.
So the question that I had was about sort of, I find talking to people, international folks on campus, that there's almost an arrogance in the anti-war movement in the United States that the United States is the only actor that matters. And I'm wondering if you could speak to the internationalism that's required. You know, yeah, the United States stops its warmongering, its military-industrial complex, but people will always say, well, then China will just do it. And I don't want to believe that it's so simplistic, but I want to know, you know, what do we say to that? How do we build those movements, especially in a place where I really don't know what anti-anything movements exist in China. I hope there's something, but, you know, what are those sorts of possibilities?
There is kind of an arrogance, the questioner said, in terms of thinking in terms of the United States being the key actor and the only actor that can change this. What about other nations? Actually, I have something. I wrote a thought piece about 6-7 years ago called The Role of Smaller Nations in nuclear disarmament, and it actually can be extended. If any nation were to take this issue with the seriousness it deserved, war and nuclear war and the connection between them, because all nations will be affected if there is a nuclear war, and as I put out, every needless war presents needless nuclear risk, then it would be a game changer. Because every chance they get, they would bring this up with the American Secretary of State, with the American President, and they could start to create a regional, what I call a pocket of awareness. It doesn't happen all at once where it spreads through all society, but you create little pockets of awareness, pockets of wisdom. And so if, for example, Norway were to do it, they might then get Sweden and Finland and Iceland. And small populations help because it makes it easier. So definitely, I could start anywhere.
I think in this context, the threat of China is way exaggerated. China is a regional power. It's exerting its might in terms of disputes over islands and its own territory and so on, Hong Kong, Tibet, but it's not interfering in the Middle East, for example. So I think that's a red herring. What I think is much more interesting, what we're seeing in the Middle East, is that as the U.S. empire declines, regional powers are exerting more control or more attempts at influence. So Iran, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, to name just three in that region, are all pushing their own interests. As long as the U.S. is the number one bully on the block, they have to respond to that. If suddenly the U.S. disappeared, part of at least what I would advocate, if the U.S. was no longer pursuing a militarist policy, it should be engaged in an active diplomatic policy to prevent interference by the regional powers as well.
My name is Imad Meshi. I'm a former journalism fellow here at Stanford. And my question is for Linda. You seem to jump from last year when not too many Americans were for bombing Syria to now where 65% are for bombing both Syria and Iraq. And the gap of what happened over that past year was perhaps that the media did focus on the Islamic State. They made a conscious decision to focus on beheadings by IS, but not beheadings by Saudi Arabia. Beheadings by the Syrian rebels, but not by the Shia militias in Iraq. So my question is, where does the media fit into the priorities of the peace movement? And why aren't there too many activists who are trying to talk to the media or influence the media to come up with a more balanced coverage, especially of the media?
So if I have the basic question correct, you're saying that the change in public, U.S. public opinion about bombing Syria in the last year was brought about, was catalyzed by the beheadings of the Islamic State?
No, by the media focus
by
on
the media. And why hasn't the media focused on?
No. Sorry, where does the media fit
into it? There were beheadings by IS, but there are also more beheadings in Saudi Arabia. There were beheadings by some of the other rebel groups that were against IS.
And because
the media focuses in on one thing, we then get caught up in it.
Right.
So the question that you want me to address is, why does the media do that?
No. If you think peace actors, the non-violence movement, has any focus at all on the media, why are you ignoring that in what you just said right now? Shouldn't the media be a part of the activism, of the work that the peace movement should be addressing?
Yeah, certainly. Of course, they're part of this large effort that we all seem to be interested in involves focusing a light on the media and how they behave and how they respond to situations and how they basically help to spin us into war. Is that the point that you were?
Yes.
Yeah. So that's a very important topic. And in my computer, I have among my many ideas of that should be done is a conference called Spun into War, and it focuses on the role of the media and how they act the way they do, and how they don't invite peace to be on television.
Stanford's undergraduate education made an emphasis on critical thinking, and I was really hopeful for that, except it doesn't seem to have hit the most critical, most important critical thinking of all, which is showing our students where they, repeatedly, the American public has been sucked in by media accounts. And you can't just blame the media, it's interesting. The public affects the media too. There's a feedback loop where the media can't get too far ahead of the public, the politicians can't get too far ahead of the public, and the media reports what the politicians say. And so it sometimes seems like it's almost impossible to get the truth injected into this system once you have lies propagating around. But it is possible, it does happen, we have to just keep plugging away. And but I think one place to start would be to educate Stanford students with examples, like go back and read Time Magazine from August 1964, I have it on my bookshelf, I bought it on eBay, and see what they said. Like that's non-existent second Tonkin Gulf incident, it's played like it was a war movie. You know, and it concludes with, and now American might be ready to strike in retaliation. Well, absolute bullshit, right? With what we now know. Why, and we've been pulled in time and time again, I would hope that, that a course like that might be created. I actually attempted to do it myself, but I have too many irons in the fire.
And speaking about the whole array of atrocities that one could have looked at instead of just focusing on the media attention to the Islamic State beheadings, there was a great article titled, a pretty good article too, in just the last couple of weeks entitled, Why Do Americans Hate Beheadings and Love Drone Killers?
Why do they hate beheadings by IS but don't mind when they blow somebody's head off, which is basically another way of putting your drone killings.
I think as a working reporter myself, I think the way to look at it is the media is not the instigator of the problem, but the transmission belt. In other words, in this context, the decisions are made in Washington, and the limits of debate are decided in Washington. Normally, it's the highest level Democrats and the highest level Republicans might have some differences. So the choice in Syria or Iraq is humanitarian intervention or good old-fashioned tub-thumping intervention. Those are choices. The idea that there shouldn't be any intervention at all is not even considered. And so within that, then, the reporters are free to write anything they want within those narrow parameters. And whatever happens on the ground is reported, but it's seen through the prism of what's going on in Washington. And a similar process if you want to do business reporting or arts reporting, it's other folks, but foreign policy follows that. And my experience is that anti-war activists are very much concerned about the media and influencing the media. I know I've given many workshops on how to approach that, how to work with your local media, how to, you know, there are a few of us around doing some, or at least trying to do some good things. How do you support those people while criticizing the people who are doing the opposite?
Yeah, support and acknowledge the great work that's being done by some people, like I would name Amy Goodman, year upon year upon year, keep doing the work and giving encouragement out of that. That's not nothing. That's nothing.
Yeah, I wanted to, before we move on, I wanted to mention an aspect of this of media literacy and critical thinking about media, also that's specific, and I think we could focus on if we taught such a course, for example, or if we made this a part of popular education, is in cases of the run-up to military intervention or war, there are inevitably people who are brought into the media as experts who argue for the war. And I think Rhys has done some work on this, and also a reporter named Lee Fong in San Francisco just wrote a terrific report about the undisclosed financial and other interests that these so-called experts often have. And so, you know, one simple technique that people could be taught is simply to question what are the motivations for the people that they're listening to on the media that might not be disclosed there, but which, in many cases, you can actually investigate on your own just by doing internet research or by looking around. Rhys, do you want to say anything more about your work on that?
Let's take some more questions.
Okay.
All right, so, cool.
Yeah, so first of all, just thanks to all the panelists for speaking about Islamic State. It's good that at Stanford some of these words are being spoken. It's kind of amazing, actually, that we're getting this perspective, so it's good. Good to hear. I'm a student, so I'm a senior at Stanford, and I'm someone interested in peace and justice studies. I'm someone who's interested in politics, current events, Islamic State, obviously, that's why I came to this event. If I'm someone similar to myself, interested in current affairs and national relations, what, Linda, you mentioned the Peace and Justice Studies Initiative, and Todd, why should I care about that? How can that inform my sense of education, wanting to understand alternative viewpoints about conflict, about war, and how can we build this sense of education at Stanford, which is not just grounded in environment where we want to go to war, or that the only options there are, like we just said, war or humanitarian aid, which is often a disguise for war.
So Cole just introduced himself as a student at Stanford who's very much involved in all of these issues. He's part of our Peace and Justice Studies committee. And he said, as a student at Stanford, where can he go? Is that what you said?
Yeah.
Yeah, where can he go?
Or what should the Peace and Justice, is that?
Right. I mean, I tried to raise that question in the last 7 minutes of my 14 minutes. I would like to see a number of things developed. This discussion we're having now, I would add to the list of hypothetical courses one entirely about media and war. You know, how are we going to get those things to happen? I used to sort of lie awake at night and kind of pull my hair and say, do I have to teach all these courses myself? They won't let me. I'm a religious studies scholar. So I realized that we have to somehow, and please everybody help us figure out how, we have to see if there are enough people on the faculty who really want to make these things happen, who want to teach courses like this, who want to fill this lacuna. At this point, I don't know. We've got one of them sitting right here who's teaching courses like that, Rushman. But we need quite a few more to have some critical mass. How do we make that happen? I'm thinking of going door to door.